The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And over the next half hour, I will be reading to you from National Geographic Traveler and AAA Go Magazine. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we will be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. About 10 years ago, my wife and I had the opportunity to spend several days in Seattle. While some of my time was job-related, I did have ample opportunity to explore the city. One of the sites we will always remember is the Seattle waterfront, which is home to the very first Starbucks, which opened nearly a century ago. And across the street is an even more legendary attraction, Pike Place Market. I had seen videos about Pike Place, where you stand in a crowded enclosed market while vendors and customers bid and bargain on the latest catch. Suddenly, as if out of nowhere, a fish flies overhead into the waiting hands of skilled fishmongers who carefully ply their craft in order to meet customers' demands. Other vendors also surround the fish market, and they sell everything from crafts to flowers. Today on Armchair Traveler, Seattle-based writer Langdon Cook is going to take us on a brief tour of Pike Place as he focuses on Seattle's historic salmon industry. His article, Big Fish Tale, is found in the April-May 2019 issue of National Geographic Traveler. Patrolling the front of his shop in bright orange deck pants, the fishmonger drums up a little impromptu drama for tourists fingering their wallets. "What's the matter?" he asks the crowd, putting his hands on his hips. "Never been properly introduced to the king before?" He extends an open hand. At Seattle's Pike Place Market, where a ragtag collection of produce, meat, and seafood stalls overlooks the city's downtown waterfront, crowds gather around comforting displays of food. Stacked like treasure on cushions of ice, several king salmon stare blankly back, their thick sides burnished with a silver sheen, as one of the top three favorite seafoods globally, along with tuna and shrimp. Salmon isn't a tough sell. Couple on vacation from Kalamazoo, Michigan, giggles and points to a 10-pounder. The fishmonger closes the deal with a pretend shake of the fin and tosses the fish theatrically to his colleague behind the counter, who makes a backhanded circus catch before brandishing a large fillet knife that gleams in his hand. Each spring, as the dogwoods begin to bloom, salmon leave their deep blue pastures of the North Pacific and return to their natal streams to spawn and die. For millennia, people in the salmon country, from Alaska to California and inland to Idaho, have celebrated this miraculous gift from the sea. To research my book on salmon culture, I traveled the region and spent time with those who know salmon best, from commercial and tribal fishermen to scientists, anglers, and chefs, all of them connected in one form or another to the ultimate wild food in North America. In mid-May, when the first Copper River kings and sockeye arrive from Alaska, a whole king of 20 or more pounds might sell for upwards of $40 per pound at Pike Place Market. Cleaned and filleted, the same fish costs nearly double. Customers hardly bat an eye. Though the prices drop as lesser-known varieties pile up throughout the season, the region's signature wild salmon are always an attraction. These handsome fish capture our imaginations like no other. And the fishmongers have learned to stage a bit of showbiz flair to move their inventory. While tossing salmon is a ritualistic practice at Pike Place Market, up the slope in Seattle's Capitol Hill neighborhood, Chef John Sundstrom doesn't seek attention with airborne fish. Instead, he serves a lightly seared fillet skin up, a formerly eyebrow-raising practice that is gaining traction in many of the city's better restaurants. The reasoning is simple, and akin to the tenets of nose-to-tail dining. Salmon skin is a delicacy that deserves wider appreciation. At Sundstrom's restaurant, and it's called Lark, the salmon is always wild, never farmed. Fittingly for a chef to incorporate specific rim details into his Northwest food, he came to appreciate salmon skin from his first cooking job at a Japanese restaurant. I learned from my Japanese chef to treasure the skin and serve it in many forms. I love the fattiness, the deep salmon flavor, and the ability to cook it crispy to provide texture to a dish. At Lark, I wouldn't dream of taking the skin off. It makes for a more pleasing presentation as well as a full expression of a salmon's flavor. Seattle is the jumping-off point for salmon eaters and anglers from all over the world heading to Alaska and its myth-shrouded fisheries. For hundreds of years, probably longer, the most revered salmon in the region were actually found to the south. After taking in the spectacle of Seattle, I continue my salmon tour to the Big River, as the Columbia is known, to Native Americans, where it borders the states of Oregon and Washington, following a route that would have been familiar to indigenous fishermen and traders long ago. The four-hour drive takes me over the Snoqualmie Pass to the far side of the Cascade Range, lush forests giving way to sagebrush-dotted plateaus and rocky canyons. With a high desert wind at my back, I skirt the Yakima Nation and the volcanic cone of Mount Adams before dropping over the lip to see the grandeur of the Columbia River Gorge, historically the greatest salmon fishery on the planet. The Spring Kings of the Columbia, also called Spring Chinook or simply Springers, migrate hundreds of miles upstream without feeding, relying on heavy stores of fat to carry them through the fall spawning. Entire indigenous societies, some of which still exist, were organized around these fish. The fish ladder at Bonneville Dam, an hour east of Portland, Oregon, is the place to see these marathoners up close, and the greeters at the dam's interpretive center understand the attraction. They direct tourists to the downstairs viewing area first. The turbines and other power-generating equipment on this, one of the most hydroelectrically developed river systems in the world, can wait. As soon as the elevator doors open, I hear the clamor. Kids and adults alike press their faces to the glass as chunky king salmon, dozens of them, move silently through the ladder, a galaxy of bubbles rushing backward in the current. "I'd like to have a couple of those in my truck," murmurs a man in coveralls. The fish enter a chute at the foot of the dam because they are naturally drawn to current. Back and forth they swim through a hard-edged concrete channel that flows like a water slide, gaining elevation through a series of stair-stepping switchbacks until they've summited and reached the reservoir on the other side. The salmon don't seem to see us as they pass through the viewing chamber just inches away. Their unblinking eyes betray no recognition, and unlike a curious leopard or gorilla at the zoo, they move through with their otherness intact. The Snake River sockeye will swim more than 900 miles upstream to a chain of subalpine lakes in the Sawtooth Mountain of central Idaho, the longest salmon migration in the contiguous United States. It's a heroic journey, one that can tire you out just thinking about it. In Oregon's Cascade Locks at Brigham Fish Market, I contemplate the mysteries of fish while ogling the silver and red slabs gleaming in the refrigerated glass case. The Brigham family belongs to the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla, and their store is the first Native American-owned brick-and-mortar fish market in the Columbia Gorge. Never mind that Umatilla tribal members have fished here since time immemorial, as it's usually put. Ask Kim Brigham Campbell where the rich sides of salmon in the case come from, and she'll nod toward the back door. Her sister, Terry Brigham, explains that most of the salmon are caught nearby by family members and friends, mainly in modern gill nets, though 15% of the catch still comes from traditional dip netting. I find Brigham and Campbell, Kim's teenage son, working on a dip net down by the side of the former locks, which were built in 1896 and became obsolete with the completion of Bonneville Dam in 1938. Today, a museum and park mark the site, with a concrete-lined channel where the boy is fishing from a platform suspended from a stone retaining wall. He figures he's been fishing since he was 6 or 7. The scaffolding that supports him hangs over the river, connected by high-tension cables. With one hand gripping a long pole, he sinks a net 10 feet down, while his other hand holds a line tied to the back of the mesh. "Sometimes on the pole I get a little tweak sideways, or it'll shake a little bit," he says of the technique, "but mostly I feel it on the string." And just like that, he pulls up the line and hauls in his net. Several shad thrash in the mesh, their large silver scales lighting up like strobes in the sun. He dumps them in a bucket and continues to fish. Earlier that morning he caught a 7-pound steelhead. Sockeye are harder to catch. "It's lucky to get just one. Two is really good. My mom got 2 yesterday. Spring Chinook, the prize fish, require extra vigilance, otherwise they can do damage. Your pole shakes. You've got to get it up fast. If it gets its head down and shakes, it'll break the net. The salmon and steelhead are all filleted and sold at the market. The shad is sold as bait to sturgeon fishermen who fish for the prehistoric-looking bottom feeders in the deep pools behind the dam." Farther east in the Columbia River Gorge, one of the consequences of the river's power-generating capabilities lies hidden below the waterline. For centuries, and possibly millennia, Sililu Falls was the epicenter of the Pacific Northwest salmon culture. Native Americans gathered at the falls each spring to catch a year's supply of salmon and to trade goods. Lewis and Clark landed there on October 22, 1805, noting it as the Great Mart of the West. Also called Wyom, which means the sound of water upon the rocks. These fish haven't been heard since March 10th, 1957, when the Dalles Dam closed its gates for the first time and flooded one of the most sacred of all fishing sites in North America. Historically, Native American communities from up and down the river traveled to Sililu each spring to catch salmon in dip nets from wooden platforms built precariously over the falls. The fishing couldn't begin, however, until the salmon had been shown the proper respect. Variations of the first salmon ceremony take place throughout the salmon country. They differ slightly from tribe to tribe, but the general outline is the same. The first salmon of the year is ritualistically shared with everyone in the community, and its skeleton cleaned and returned to the river and floated downstream. In this way, the ambassador from the salmon tribe can return to its underwater kin and tell of the respect it received from the human beings living upstream, so that more of its kind will ascend and nourish the people. Once the salmon fishing ceremony has been performed with its rituals of drumming, dancing, fasting, and feasting, which might take place over several days, the fishing season can then begin in earnest. Before the dam building era, the fishing closures built into such rites had the effect of allowing more salmon to reach their upstream spawning grounds, ensuring future runs for harvest. Spiritual game management, it's been called. Today, the powwow that accompanies the Sililu First Salmon Ceremony, usually held in mid-April at the village longhouse, is open to the public, with a salmon picnic to follow. Traditional dip netting can still be seen in the Columbia and its tributaries. These fishing sites represent some of the longest continuously inhabited places in the Americas, and though the river is no longer the fishery it once was, it's still the heart of salmon country. Before leaving the gorge, I stop by the Bridge of the Gods in Cascade Locks, where the Pacific Crest Trail crosses the Columbia River, to try one last bite of smoked Chinook sold from the back of a tribal member's pickup. In the shadow of this modern cantilever bridge, named for an ancient Native American myth, I savor the richness of wild salmon, a taste both old and new, and unlike any other fish from the sea. As a tribal elder once told me, we are not wealthy, but we always have salmon. And if you might be interested in taking a closer look at salmon country yourself, we have some travel-wise tips that accompany Mr. Cook's article. What to know? Well, Columbia spring Chinook season is typically April and May. Check the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife for regulations. And places to stay? Well, we have the Hood River Hotel, recently renovated but retaining vintage details. This 41-room lodging in the Columbia River Gorge is on the National Register of Historic Places. Ground-level rooms are dog-friendly, and you can find out more at hoodriverhotel.com, hoodriverhotel.com. Then there's the Inn at the Market. It's located on-site at Pike Place Market. This 76-room boutique hotel has expansive views of the Seattle waterfront from some rooms and a rooftop deck for sunset cocktails. InnAtTheMarket.com. That's InnAtTheMarket.com. And then where to dine? Well, the Sililu Restaurant and Bar, locally and sustainably sourced fish, meats, and produce, star at Sililu and Hood River. An A-list seller highlights Oregon wine. SililuRestaurant.com. It's spelled C-E-L-I-L-O. SililuRestaurant.com. Then we have the Double Mountain Brewery, creating notable craft brews, including an oatmeal stout and a brut IPA. This Hood River Brewery and Tap Room is also known for its tasty pizza. The venue hosts live music acts regularly. Check it out at DoubleMountainBrewery.com. That's DoubleMountainBrewery.com. Then we have The Lark, in the Capitol Hill neighborhood. This top Seattle restaurant, helmed by Chef John Sunstrom, celebrates Pacific Northwest ingredients, from oysters and wild salmon to sunchokes and black trumpet mushrooms. LarkSeattle.com is where you find more information. That's LarkSeattle.com. And if you're interested in a tour, You can go with Nat Geo Expeditions Columbia and Snake Rivers Voyage. It's a 7-day cruise aboard the new National Geographic Quest, retracing the path of Lewis and Clark's trailblazing expedition through the Pacific Northwest. Guests journey through the Columbia River Gorge, go on hiking and biking excursions, and sample local food and wine. More information can be found at natgeoexpeditions.com/explore. That's natgeoexpeditions.com/explore. So lots of fun there. By the way, writer Langdon Cook is the author of Upstream, Searching for Wild Salmon from River to Table. That's the book he was referring to in his article. His articles include photographs that are taken by Alaska commercial fisherman Corey Arnold. He lives in Portland, Oregon. Next, we're going to flip a few pages and find the downtime section in the April-May 2019 issue of National Geographic Traveler. And here, writer-editor Brooke Sabin is going to introduce us to city secrets and weekend getaways in the opening commentary titled Chilling Out. Are you ready for this? Columns of steam rise into the air as pools of water boil and churn like some kind of giant's cauldron. In Iceland, the planet reveals its inner workings in astonishing ways. A top spot to witness this geological phenomenon is the Namajal in the northeast, in the part of the country just off the Ring Road. Paths lead right to the edge of the action, a hot way to cool down, or a cool way to warm up on one of the world's most dynamic islands, according to Brooke. And now, let's take a look at what she's going to tell us about having some downtime in Tokyo. And we go beyond sushi. Western food in Japan's capital is some of the world's best, and Stan Parrish is the writer for this section. In 2007, Ivan Orkin, a self-described Jewish guy from Long Island, became the first American to serve ramen in Tokyo, ramen that earned him instant acclaim and endless lines. Today, Orkin is chef owner of the equally mobbed Ivan Ramen and Ivan Ramen Slurp Shop in New York. His Instagram account, at Ramen Junkie, acts as a kind of a restaurant guide to New York and Tokyo, which he visits often. I get asked for recommendations all the time, Orkin says, and I'm always pushing people to go beyond sushi and yakitori and tempura. The Neapolitan pizza in Tokyo is as good or better than anything you'll find in Naples. Same goes, rather, for French pastry. The Japanese are known as experts copyists, but don't expect an exact facsimile of Western food. When you eat foreign cuisine in Japan, Orkin says, it's always filtered through the sensibility of the Japanese. And we have several examples to give you. Here we go. The burger. Double burger at Henry's Burger. Chef Kentaro Nakahara offers just two items here. A burger, single, double, or triple patty, and fries. The 100% Wagyu patty is roughly chopped rather than finely ground, formed into a ball and cooked smash burger style on a flat top. The accoutrements are carefully chosen to showcase the beef. A whisper of a bun that almost disappears between your fingers, a single disc or a ripe tomato, crisp lettuce, and a slice of cheddar that melts into the meat. The Thousand Island-like sauce has just enough tang to underscore the meat's richness without masking the flavor. This is the hamburger distilled to its fundamental pleasure points. You can, should, and probably will have more than one. Then we have pizza. Yes, marinara pie at Pizza Studio Tamaki. Tsubasa Tamaki has never set foot in Italy. The chef honed his craft at Tokyo Pizzeria Savoy and Strada, both of which have been called the city's best. In February 2017, Tamaki struck out on his own and earned a Michelin star. The smoked mozzarella on his signature Tamaki pie is a revelation, but no order is complete without a marinara pizza because any cheese is ultimately a distraction from the towering achievement of his crust. It's lightly blistered and blackened at the edges, in contrast to the chewy, supple center, which, unlike the Neapolitan version, never goes soft. Toppings are distributed to offer the perfect ratios in every bite. And is this the world's best pizza? You'll be hard-pressed to say no. I get the feeling that Stan Parrish, our writer, really likes pizza. Then we move on to modern French. Pigeon with gut sauce at L'Effervescence. L'Effervescence is nominally French, a label that doesn't much interest chef Shinobu Name. I don't care how it's characterized or categorized, he says, of the food that earned him 2 Michelin stars. I want to be free, and I want you to feel free. Freedom in this case means blending techniques and traditions for maximum pleasure and effect. Take the small gold leaf bowl filled with a vibrant blend of wine and sake presented at the start of the meal. Pigeon grilled over straw for a sharp, woodsy smokiness was served over a rich gut sauce, that's in quotes, and finely diced piles of gingered clam from the Hokkaido. It was paired with a juicy cote rote. The 8-course lunch is probably the best $100 you can spend on a meal here or anywhere. Then we have pasta. Squid ink pasta at Bulgari Il Ristorante Luca Fenton. Chef Luca Fenton of the Treviso, Italy, imports very little from his homeland for the thrilling modern Molto Italiano dishes he's serving above the Bulgari Boutique in Ginza Tower. Yes, the dry pasta comes from Italy. So does the top-notch wine selection, aged Carnaroli rice, and the Parmigiano Reggiano. Almost everything else is sourced in Japan, which has more in common rather with Italy than you might think. They have the same seasons. They're on the same parallel, Fenton says. Jet black, squid ink, spaghetti, sticked with a squid stock, and topped with raw Aiore Ica reef squid, which melts in your mouth thanks to the meticulous knife work that Fenton hones with everyday practice. Then we have steak, yes, filet and steak sandwich at Shima Steak. There's no street-level sign for Shima Steak and no writing on the door that sits below a branch of the Japanese chain Tully's Coffee. The easiest way to find the restaurant is the occasional narcotic waft of roasting Wagyu beef, which Chef Oshima Manabu imports from his native Kyoto, wet ages, and cooks on a rotisserie skewers in an oven of his own design. Shima's steak sandwich is Instagram famous. 2 slices of Pullman bread slathered in house-made secret sauce and stuffed with grilled Wagyu scraps. It's sliced into thirds and packed into a bento box for the road, the takeout of emperors. According to the hostess, the sandwich should never see the inside of a refrigerator and should be consumed within 24 hours. You might want to keep that in mind if you happen to pick up a steak sandwich during your travel. And then we have these don't-miss masterfully mixed drinks. Here we go. Martini at Mori Bar. Takeo Mori, 71, is considered the grandfather of the martini in Japan, and his signature version served at the tiny windowless 10th-floor bar bearing his name in Ginza. Punchy Boodle's gin is tempered by a touch of vermouth, a drop of orange bitters, and a faint mist of lemon. It's a potent and perfect take on the classic. The elegant diamond-etched coupe is bigger than it looks, so order more than one at your own risk. Then we have the bartender's choice at Bar High Five. The encyclopedic selection of spirits takes up an entire wall at Bar High Five in Ginza. Give one of the talented bartenders a few data points on your preferences and prepare to be pleasantly surprised by exotic local liqueurs that elevate the classics and create entirely new cocktails found nowhere else. Then we have the 6 cocktail tasting at Gin Yamamoto. A 6-drink tasting sounds excessive, but spirits take a back seat to seasonal fruits and vegetables at this 8-seat bar. On a recent night, fresh plum juice was spiked with cherry brandy and a touch of wasabi, while grated kabocha squash was enlivened with toasted squash seeds and smoky Japanese whiskey. 6 drinks here feel like not enough. Oh, my word. Well, on our next Armchair Traveler, we're going to continue with downtime city secrets and weekend getaways, and we'll be exploring Scotland, Geneva, Switzerland, and Silicon Valley, California. We hope you'll join us as we continue this little exploration for you foodie and beverage adventurers, okay? Well, in our remaining time, let's say we turn to the Carolina Road Trip Planner in the May-June 2019 issue of AAA Go Magazine. And already this month, we've had the Aiken Bluegrass Festival in Aiken, South Carolina, and that took place May 10th and 11th. Then we had the Artisphere Art Festival in Greenville, South Carolina, which took place May 10th through 12th. And then we had the train day at the depot in Spartanburg, South Carolina. And that took place on May 11th. So now we're going to start with May 18th, when we have the Saluda Arts Festival, historic downtown Saluda, North Carolina. Features varied art media, including oil, watercolor, and acrylic paintings, pottery, wood carving, metalworking, sculpture, and jewelry, painted furniture, stained glass, and more. In addition, there are musical performances, local food, and a children's tent. And the nice thing about all this activity, it's all free. Yep. You can go enjoy it. Saluda.com is where you find more information about the Saluda Arts Festival. Saluda.com. May 25th and 27th, we have the Lake Lure Arts and Crafts Festival. This should be a lot of fun. Lake Lure, as you remember, is where they filmed that movie, Dirty Dancing. Arcade Street in Lake Lure, North Carolina. Stroll by more than 90 artisans and enjoy continuous food and entertainment for families. And this, too, is free as far as entry is concerned. And you can get more information at LakeLureArtsAndCraftsFestivals.com. That's LakeLureArtsAndCraftsFestival.com. Then, May 31st to June 1st, we had the Ava Gardner Festival, and that's in nearby Smithfield, North Carolina. Learn about the iconic movie actress who was born in Johnston County. This year's festival features a new exhibit, Ava, My Real Story, which showcases the personal side of the actress. There will also be free movies, heritage tours, and much more. There are some fees sometimes. Sometimes it's free. Just depends on what you're interested in. Check it out at JohnstonCountyNC.org. JohnstonCountyNC.org. Now we move into June. Let's take a look at what's happening in the month ahead. We have the Roads and Rails on June 1st, Aiken Visitor Center and Train Museum in Aiken, South Carolina. You can hear a live band perform railroad songs and a little country, and you can check the website for more dates, and this event has a free entry. Visit AikenSC.com is where you can get more information. Visit AikenSC.com. And Arts by the Sea Festival takes place June 8th, downtown Front Street in Swansboro, North Carolina. And this festival showcases pottery, jewelry, painting, stained glass, carvings, photography, sculpture, metalwork, kids zone, and much more. Live entertainment will perform throughout the day, and this too is free to enjoy. It's at the SwansboroFestivals.com for more information, SwansboroFestivals.com. For more about the Arts by the Sea Festival, again, that's downtown Front Street in Swansboro, June 8th. And also on June 8th, we had the Mount Airy Blooms, various locations, Mount Airy, North Carolina. You can stroll through 12 private gardens, listen to master gardener presentations, dine under an outdoor pavilion, and experience the magic of Mayberry. Several gardens are located in historic downtown and sponsored by local garden clubs. There is a fee involved in this, and you can get more information at visitmayberry.com. That's visitmayberry.com. And June 14th is Flag Day. The Battleship North Carolina at Wilmington. Fly your own flag at the Battleship. American Legion will assist visitors in hoisting and folding their flags. Visitors can bring a flag or buy one at the ship's store. Sales go to the preservation of the Battleship. It's free with admission, and you can get more at BattleshipNC.com. BattleshipNC.com. Yep, we've run out of time for our travels today on Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed what we've done today, and if you look forward to next week, we hope that you'll join us. I'm Mike Edwards. I've been reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, content of our program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And the broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.